Hey everyone, we're so excited to have Emily Rubin on Off Our Rockers today. And I met Emily when I lived in Ithaca, and I knew from the moment I met her that Emily was destined to do great things. And she currently is doing really great things as a professor at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School, where she does work with siblings of kids who have different types of behavioral issues. So Emily, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a treat to be here.
So tell us a little bit about how you arrived at this place in your life where you're now a professor doing this amazing work.
Well, I know we don't have, hours and hours, so I'll give you the abbreviated version, which is that about 10 or 12 years ago, I recognized in my work that there were very few supports available for family members of kids that have mental health issues or behavioral problems, even though their behavior can impact the entire family unit and can really impact family stability, resiliency among siblings. It can increase trauma in very severe situations. So I decided, well, somebody should really create some kind of program to support family members of kids with mental health issues. And then I ended up being that person. So I was invited to join the medical school after a year-long fellowship in which I was doing some research on the impact of disability on families and family members. And then I just started doing research on what it really looks like for families to have an individual with behavioral problems in their family. And I piloted my research study at Cambridge Health Alliance in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that was in 2011. And since then, we've had over 2,500 family members participate. And I've trained about close to 100 clinicians that practice family-centered mental health care, because the program that I developed, which has now been recognized by the Department of Mental Health in Massachusetts, is a program that not only provides support and services for family members, for all members of the family, but also serves as a training rotation for psychiatry residents and mental health trainees to get some hands-on experience in working with typically developing siblings. So it's just been amazing working with all these really important clinicians and families and learning a lot from them. And I feel really blessed.
I think that what you're doing is amazing. I think it's such important work. And I'm the mother of three kids. They're now adults. But over the years, at any given time, one of the three was going through something. There was some crisis or whatever it was. And sometimes the other two would rise to the challenge. But other times it was just, cries, it's not fair. They're getting all the attention. And I don't think I ever saw material or anything to read about it to help. So I think what you're doing is really, really important.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That sense of injustice is one that's very prevalent among all kinds of siblings, but particularly among siblings of kids with mental health issues. There's a pervasive sense, actually, of confusion and injustice. And one of the things I end up talking with parents a lot is this idea that fair isn't always equal. Mm. And that's a hard concept for parents and for kids. But it's, I think it's a universal issue. There's kind of typical sibling rivalry that most parents have experience with. And then there's an elevated level that I deal with. So I'm a clinical social worker, and I do have a private practice that focuses exclusively on sibling issues.
I worked for many years as a school counselor at a school for kids. It was a special education school. And sometimes there was more than one sibling in the family who had learning issues or challenges or behavior issues, but often there wasn't. And the child that, the one that isn't getting all the attention, not attention, but the resources, often was just shuffled off into the shadows. And the issues would be under the surface for a long time and then emerge in a big explosion sometimes.
Right. And that's a very typical dynamic that we see. And most of the siblings that I work with are wise beyond their years, because they've grown up getting less parental attention and having to fend for themselves more. And while some of them have been parentified, meaning that they've taken on responsibilities that they're not developmentally ready for, they also seem to be better equipped to handle crises and conflicts as they get older. So it's a really interesting dynamic.
Families find you? Like, how do they know to find the resources?
Well, you know, since COVID, especially because everything now is remote and the work I'm doing is completely remote, we've been serving families across the country. So if people Google me, then, or Google sibling support, Emily Rubin, then they'll find. So one of the things we offer are groups that are for different family members that occur simultaneously. So last week, for example, we had about close to 50 family members. We had a group for young siblings, which was this peer support group that's facilitated by trainees. There, we had a group for teen siblings, and then we had we had 10 in each of those groups. And then we had a group for parents who were participating in the program for the first time, and they meet with our parent mentor who brings lived experience. And she talks about what it's like for kids to grow up with a brother or sister with special needs and specific parenting strategies that parents can use to try to increase their resiliency. And then I have a group for follow-up parents that have returned because they are under so much stress and they need some follow-up support. And when I say parents, I should say caregivers, because we work with any adult in a caregiving role. So we have grandparents and aunts and uncles and foster care parents. And likewise with siblings, we will work with any child that's growing up in the home. So we have cousins, stepbrothers, stepsisters, sometimes best friends. I mean, many people are in alternative family arrangements, and we work with everyone. When I first started doing this work, I'm not the first person to have recognized the impact on siblings. But when I first started doing research, I saw that the only sibling programs that I could find were drop-off models. So parents would drop off the sibling and the sibling would do some terrific activity and talk about their feelings. And then the parent would pick them up and say, "So how did your group go?" And the kid might say, "Well, I don't know. It was fine, whatever." And the parent actually had no idea what really happened. So it became important to me to incorporate all the caregivers and all the kids in the family so that the family unit itself could develop a new way of talking about mental health issues and address a lot of the elephants in the room. I mean, typically, because there's so much stigma around mental health and mental illness, a lot of parents are walking this uncomfortable line of trying to maintain a child's privacy and being honest with the other kids about what's happening. So what we find is that a lot of very well-intentioned parents are instructing kids to lie because they don't want people to know that maybe one of their kids attempted suicide, or one of their kids, was running away or taking drugs, or all the different issues that can land a child in a psych unit. So what sometimes these parents would say to the brother or sister is, if anyone asks, tell them that your brother went to Disney World to visit grandma. And, you know, that doesn't seem like it's such a terrible thing to do, but it actually has a real impact on the siblings. We know that kids should never have to lie about scary stuff happening at home, and that in and of itself can increase anxiety and potentially depression among kids. So one of the things that's important to me is making sure that families know that there are other ways to talk openly and honestly while protecting everyone's privacy in the family.
So what might that look like, Emily, if you're talking to your child and you're worried about what they're going to say or how they're going to say it, and you don't want them to lie, but you don't want them to perhaps say something that might be hurtful to the other sibling?
So that's a great question. So let's take a hypothetical situation where there's a child who has been psychiatrically hospitalized for some reason. So what I tell parents to do is, if parents are co-parenting, if there's more than one parent, then the co-parents try to get on the same page about who they feel comfortable knowing about the situation and what they feel comfortable having those people know specifically. So, and then once they work that through, then they together come up with three kind of pitches that they give the child in the hospital. And they say, if someone wants, if your auntie or school friend or someone asks where you are, we can tell them that A, you are having a episode of depression and you needed treatment. Or we could tell them that you're not feeling well and you needed to have some private time. We could tell them that you have a medical condition and, you know, we're not going to share the details of it. Or we could tell them that, you know, you needed to go somewhere where you could get one-on-one attention. You know, it's really whatever the family, what the parents feel comfortable with sharing. And then that becomes the language that that the kids can use in the family. So instead of having to lie and say, oh, my brother went to Disneyland, the child can say, well, my brother's in a special program where he gets to rollerblade in the hallway and eat chicken nuggets every day for lunch. So, and that is a way to protect privacy.
You know, hopefully, though, I think that the stigma around mental health issues is slowly going away and people are more open about it. I think people are more comfortable saying they're in therapy or their kids are in therapy. So hopefully that sense of secrecy will hopefully evaporate, because that's so stressful in itself, having to keep. And I think that's so damaging, too, down the line, having to keep a family secret. It's so unhealthy.
It's very toxic. And we do talk a lot with parents about the culture of mental health in their families. Some families are very private and don't want other people to know what's going on. And other families are very open about it. And interestingly, what I find is that moms and dads tend to not always be on the same page with that. Sometimes the mom is very open. Sometimes the dad might, you know, want to be more private. One of the things I often hear is that when there's a mental health crisis in a family, it's not a casserole illness. So no one's going to be bringing you a casserole if your child has attempted suicide. Or I shouldn't say nobody, but it's not, you know, it's in part because parents are so reluctant to share this information because they can feel so judged. But the irony is that once people start talking openly about what's really happening in their families, they find that there's so much more support than they realized, because every family is touched by mental health issues or mental illness. You know, as soon as you say to someone, oh, my daughter had to go to the hospital for an eating disorder, they'll hear, oh, that happened to my niece, or I struggled with that. Or so it is getting over this hurdle of feeling comfortable with talking about stuff that our culture has made uncomfortable.
I think that's so true. And I think that, you know, when your kid breaks a leg, you're like, oh, my kid broke a leg, but there's some, you don't feel shame about that, guilt or something that you might feel when it's something like a mental illness, or it's a drug problem, or it's something that you feel sort of might reflect on you as a parent, that you didn't do a good job, or that you're somehow responsible for what has happened to your child, that they ended up with an eating disorder, or they ended up in whatever the problem might be.
No, I think Sue, you're so right. But I think also you and Dana are in the midst of high school, where there's such status about how your child's doing, if they're taking AP classes, where they're going up to college. And I can assure everybody who's listening, now that I'm out of that, my kids are all adults, that just fades away. And all the things that you cared about, like, you know, I used to care about what people thought about us as a family. Then you realize no one cares. No one really cares. And you lose track. But when you're in the thick of it, it's really, it just feels like a pressure cooker.
And that makes me think, Emily, like, I would imagine that for siblings who are younger, say 5 or 6, that the issues that they're facing within the family might be different than when they're teenagers. And they're trying, you know what, I mean, being a teenager is all about separating from your family, right? And finding your own identity. And yet I would imagine that it might be possible that the parents would expect more from that sibling to stay close to the sibling who's having problems, or that they might expect them to play a slightly different role than they might have to otherwise.
That's exactly right. And what I see is that sibling roles change over time as siblings get older, and young siblings have very different concerns than teenage siblings and young adult siblings and adult siblings. So young siblings might think things like, will I catch this? Will mom and dad send me to the hospital? If I have bad behavior, ... So there's a lot of anxiety among young kids. And then as children become teenagers, they do go through this period of individuation, and they start to think, what's going to happen to my brother or sister when mom or dad are gone? And so then there can be some really important conversations around what do siblings want their roles to be? And then as young adults, a lot of siblings will make plans based on their relationship with their brother or sister. Some siblings want to go as far away to college as possible. Other siblings want to stay nearby because they want to be available and be involved. And then, of course, as siblings get older, they're navigating very complex systems of healthcare and benefits and housing and employment. So it's a lifelong situation for many people. For some people, and this is sort of, I think, what you guys had alluded to earlier, that over the years, when kids grow up, and no one's immune to some mental health issues along the way, but there is a small percentage of kids who do have lifelong mental illness, and that impacts siblings for the rest of their lives. But many of the kids that I work with, it feels like they are faced with sort of a developmental hump, and then they have a lot of conflict that comes around, you know, school bullying or body image. And once they get the proper support that they need and the family get the support the family needs, then it becomes something that happened in the past and people are able to move on and lead very functional lives.
You mentioned adult kids. Do you think it's, in your opinion, do you think it's fair for the parents to ask adult kids to take care of a sibling once the parents are no longer with us? Do you think that's okay? That must be a very tricky road.
Well, that's a great question. And actually it's a question I get a lot. And I believe very strongly that siblings should not have to, well, let me back up a step and say that this is a very culturally dependent response or question, because different cultures have different ideas about roles of family members. So in culture that I grew up in, I can say that I feel like siblings need to make their own decisions about what they want their roles to be, because I think that most siblings do the right thing and want to be helpful. But once a parent tells them they have to be in a caregiver or guardianship role, then that can create a lot of conflict. So I think it's always better for the sibling to come to that decision him or herself.
And wouldn't that change over time too? What's right at 1 year may not be what's right 5 years from now. And I'm thinking, as you go through your life, through the cycles, things change, and you may not want to care for a sibling, you know, at some point, but at a different point in your life, you certainly do.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of sort of plans that families make are flexible. They're considered these sort of living plans, so that when life happens, the plan can be adapted.
I just think about, for us, we grew up with a grandmother who had a lot of mental health struggles. And I think I don't want to speak for you or Dana or Sue, but I'm sure it affected us as we parented, and our own hopes and fears for our kids and our own parenting. But I mean, you're right. No one goes through life unscathed by mental health issues. It really is in every family. And I think you're doing great work about taking away the shame, a needless shame and stigma for it. It's just, I think everybody is touched by it.
I was thinking about how it's changed over time. So when I grew up, we didn't talk about mental health, barely at home, and then at school, not at all. But now I see my kids coming home with information from their classes and their teachers about even like mental health days or stress relief, what's happening with during final exams or during COVID. We talk a lot about mental health with the schools communicating directly to the parents. And it makes me think the stigma is less there now than it was a generation ago. Do you think that's true too?
Well, I do think that overall there is less stigma, but it depends on where in the country your family lives. So there are going to be some areas of the country which are much more open to talking about mental health and addressing mental health issues, especially during COVID, when mental health incidences among young people has just skyrocketed. So I think that there is more overall, more acceptance, less stigma. There's also, so happy to see this acceptance of gender fluidity among kids. And I think that, you know, it's so interesting when I'm working with families, I really see that the younger people, the kids are the ones who are so much more open-minded, so much less judgmental. So I have great faith in the younger generation. And speaking of judgment, I wanted to mention that what I found is that parental attitude, and this is not just me, there are other people who have done research on sibling dynamics, but parental attitudes around disability trickle down to the siblings. So you had mentioned, you know, your grandmother's illness. But if we have a parent that's very ashamed and in denial about the issues that the child is facing, then the siblings tend to adopt that. Whereas if we have parents who are very accepting and supportive and non-blaming, then the siblings tend to follow that as well.
You said something that struck me about gender fluidity. And years ago, I worked with a family, and one of the kids was transitioning from female to male. And the siblings kind of fell by the wayside because that was such an intense family situation. And later issues came out, and one of the siblings said, I really miss having my sister. You know, and that was kind of brushed under the rug, that she wasn't entitled to feel that way. She had to be supportive. And I think that's probably, is that something you're seeing more in your work?
I see many more kids that are transitioning. I think the most important thing that we can do for siblings is to validate their experience. So validating their experience would, I often use this example of a family that I worked with many years ago now. And the daughter, who is a young teenager, maybe 13, said to her, Mom, I hope my brother never comes home from the hospital. And her brother had been hospitalized for aggressive behavior and had been very aggressive to this little girl. And the mom said, I know that's not true. I know you want your brother to come home. I know you miss your brother. Remember all those sleepovers you had? And this 13-year-old girl just, I saw her face just kind of fell. And it was as though she was absolutely unheard. So to validate that child's experience, the mom could have said something like, I can understand why you wouldn't want your brother to come home right now. He's been really mean to you. And that makes sense to me. So validating a child's experience helps them recognize that their feelings are just as important as everybody else's, and that their mom or dad or caregiver values them enough to be able to reflect back what they've heard. So validation goes a long way.
I just think it's fascinating. I think about how much, you know, having my sisters affected my life growing up. And I just think it's a fascinating dynamic to think about how the sibling dynamic within a family. I just think it's endlessly fascinating.
And I do too. So one of the things I'm particularly interested in is birth order and the impact of disability on kids who fall into a different birth order. I actually haven't done any analysis on that, but that's something that I'm really interested in. And also so the program that I developed is called the Sibling Support Program, a Family-Centered Mental Health Initiative, which is it's a very long name. And currently what I'm doing now is I've rolled out a follow-up study to look at outcomes among families that participate in the sibling support program and families that opt not to participate, to look at how they're faring at 1 month and 6 months and 12 months down the line, to see if have there been hospitalizations, has the family incorporated more coping skills that they learned about in the program. Have kids been going to therapy? Have they been more open to talking about what's happening in their family? So I'm really curious to see what that data tells. And I'm expanding my work now to address not just siblings of kids with mental health issues, but specifically siblings of kids with autism spectrum disorder. And then I'm going to be comparing the impact of my program on siblings of kids with autism, siblings of kids with mental health issues, and siblings of kids with autism and additional diagnoses. So about a year from now, I'll have a good update for you.
For, you know, parents who are in this situation, like you were talking about how yours is a family-centered therapy program, how might that be different from, or what does that provide that might be different than another type of therapy program that somebody might get for their children or for themselves?
Well, what family-centered means is that a clinician is looking at the impact of a disability on every member of the family. And so treating the whole family as the patient, and it's not just the one identified patient that gets support, but it's really the entire unit.
Is that becoming more common?
It's definitely a trend that I'm happy to see that it is a trend that's more and more common. The other trend in mental health care has to do with the use of parent mentors that bring lived experience, and they walk the walk and they talk the talk, and they are able to develop a rapport much more quickly than most clinicians can, who don't necessarily bring that lived experience to the table. And they carry tremendous credibility among families of kids with mental health issues. So the parent mentor piece is a big part of what I do. So we have, initially when I first started my program, we had clinicians who were trying to recruit families, and nobody showed up. And I want to give a big shout out to Bertucci's, because they provided 16 pizzas for free that first night of our pilot, and no families showed up. And then one of my colleagues said, we need to get a parent on the phone with these families. We need parent-to-parent contact. So I started recruiting parent mentors, and our numbers just skyrocketed.
I think that's really interesting, because I think when a family, I mean, I know when my kids were little, when you're in crisis, you need someone to come and help you. It's hard sometimes to reach out for help when you're so deep in the thick of it. And having someone, I think, reach out to you and just offer support would be so welcome.
Oh, yes. One of our parent mentors, our main parent mentor, has called, I think, over 7,000 families in the Northeast.
Wow. That's because amazing.
It's a very labor-intensive recruitment strategy, but she calls every family of children that are admitted to hospitals that participate in my program. So, and the turnover rate is unfortunately pretty high, and pediatric and adolescent hospitalizations tend to be shorter than I think they should be. But as a result of that, there's a lot of phone calls to these families. During COVID, we expanded the program to support families, as I said. Well, initially we just expanded to support families across Massachusetts, and then it kind of expanded to the Northeast region. And now we're really working with families across the country, because people can just, you know, zoom in to our intervention.
I'm a big believer in support groups. I think knowing that other people are going through the same thing that you're going through is just such a comfort.
It's a real community. And that's what I see happening in these groups that we run. I mean, the teenagers all want to get together outside of the group in online ways with their new friends, who for the first time, many of them have actually met a kid who understands what they're going through and what their life is like. And likewise for the parents, for them to be in a space that's so accepting and non-judgmental, and everyone speaks their language, that's really powerful. Last week, one of the moms in the group said, can we talk about mealtime next week? I had mentioned that families, especially American families, get so preoccupied with family dinner. Family connections can happen at any time of day. It doesn't have to be at dinner when kids are exhausted. And if you have a child with mental health issues, that tends to be the witching hour. So that was, you know, when she said, I'd love to talk more about dinner and how to handle that, everyone's nodding their head. And then parents start saying things that they never would say at their PTA meeting, like, I let my kids eat whatever, whenever, wherever. And that has really diminished the stress in her family. So there's just a lot of kind of outside of the box thinking and support and resource sharing. And it really feels like an honor to be able to work with these families.